Hi there, and welcome back to the Who Goes There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is going to be the first of my zoomed out author episodes in Who Goes There 2.0, where instead of focusing on a single book, we look more broadly at an author's overall work. So for this episode, we're going to be looking at Isaac Asimov, and my guest is Alec Nevala Lee, who is the author of the excellent Astounding, the multi-party biography of the golden age of science fiction, and also Inventor of the Future, a fascinating biography of Buckminster Fuller. So hi there, Alec, and welcome.
Thanks, Seth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And thanks so much for taking one for the team and helping me kind of get this series off the ground of the zoomed out episodes where we're, rather than looking at a single book, we're going to be looking at an author's entire work and kind of highlighting where someone might like to start, if they've started with the author, where they should go from there, and also, of course, some background and in information about the author. And I think that's obviously where you will come in as kind of a historian.
Yes. Any excuse to talk about this stuff, I will happily take.
Excellent. Perfect. So let's go ahead and start with a little background on you. I think a lot of people know you from Astounding, but anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, so in this context, I think I'm best known for being the author of a book called Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction, which came out in 2018 and was a Hugo and Locus Award finalist, and kind of came out of my longstanding interest in science fiction. I've been a contributor to Analog magazine for a long time. I've written novels. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the history of the field. And I was delighted to have the chance to write this group biography of Campbell and that circle of writers, who got together starting in the late 30s.
Did it start off as a biography of one person, or did you always envision it as a multi-party biography?
It definitely began with Campbell. So just for context, you know, John W. Campbell was the editor of the magazine that was best known as Astounding Science Fiction, starting in 1937. And he always struck me as an incredibly interesting figure for a lot of reasons, very controversial for good reason, but also very influential and an incredible personal life and a lot of drama in his story. So I was like, you know, a Campbell biography would be a book I want to read. And so I definitely tried to develop that with Campbell as the center. And then my editor very reasonably suggested that, you know, while Campbell is a very intriguing figure, you know, he is not famous in the way that might justify this kind of big book. And she said, are there other writers you can bring into the story? And I said, well, with Campbell, the three names that come to mind are Asimov, Heinlein, and Hubbard. And she said, great. And that's kind of how the book happened. It began with Campbell, then gradually expanded to these four writers. And, you know, as you know, the book also covers a lot of other people from that period, writers, fans. So it's a big book. It definitely expanded as it went along.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can wholeheartedly endorse it. It's one that I'd like to go back and reread, actually. I listened to the audiobook a couple years ago.
Oh,
and
nice.
I thought it was great. So, and so much in there that I had no clue about. It was very cool.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it definitely was a book that had to be written, and I'm very lucky that I got to be the one to write it.
Yeah. So what is your background? I mean, where do you come from, and how do you end up writing a book about Campbell?
So I originally was a fiction writer. I began as a novelist, and as I mentioned, you know, I had written for Analog magazine, kind of by chance. You know, that's where I published my first few stories, and I've kept, you know, writing short fiction there for a long time. And so when the idea came to me to write a nonfiction book about the history of the field, it's like you could start anywhere, right? There are countless figures you could pick to be your central through line protagonist. And Campbell I chose mostly because it fit nicely with the magazine that I knew best, that I had been published in. I knew the editors there. I knew a lot of writers from that period, or I knew I could get access to writers from that period. And so I picked Campbell in part because it made sense. You know, it certainly suited my background. And in some ways, my interests, you know, I love hard science fiction. I think, you know, it's a fun genre to write in and to think about. And, you know, to me, it's kind of like my, what I think of as like the main line of American science fiction, you know, kind of runs through Campbell, Astounding, through things like Star Trek. And again, you can kind of debate if that's true or not. But, you know, to me, when I think of science fiction, I think of these writers first.
Okay. And are you the kind of person, I'm not sure if we're similar in age. I may be a little older than you. Did you grow up on things like Star Trek and Star Wars and and all of that?
You know, it's funny. Like I'm kind of like a 90s kid. Okay. And so my big reference points were things like the X-Files. You know, if you look at my own fiction, you know, that's kind of the stuff I grew up enjoying. And, you know, I mean, I'm a Star Trek fan. I'm not a completist. You know, I have not watched a lot of the series. I'm kind of like I respond to that show's spirit, I guess, and its principles and its values more than I've spent like hours and hours watching it.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, growing up, like one of my rules as a writer is to try to like spend time thinking about the stuff I thought was cool when I was 10. And this stuff certainly qualifies. You know, I loved reading science fiction. I loved thinking about that period. And I loved, you know, especially the idea of like being a science fiction writer, being a pulp writer, you know, being someone who could earn a living writing short fiction, you know, which is amazing. You know, it's not true anymore. But, you know, during this time, you could make a pretty good living, you know, by writing for someone like Campbell, you know, which to me was always like really fascinating what that life would have been like.
Yeah. And you definitely get a slice of that. I mean, a pretty detailed slice about it in Astounding. Then more recently, you published a biography of Buckminster Fuller called Inventor of the Future, which as I was listening to it, I was like, it's more like inventor of his own past.
Yeah. I seem to be drawn to certain types. You know, maybe we can talk about this later, but Fuller to me was kind of like a cool, obvious, you know, next step in terms of what's my next book about. Mm-hmm. You know, Fuller was not a science fiction writer, but he was sort of a science fiction hero. You know, he was a futurist and someone who stood for the future, you know, in the minds of a lot of Americans. And also kind of this like, you know, self-made icon and the way that someone like Hubbard was, you know, sort of this very American kind of figure where, you know, he embellished some things, you know, not everything he said was true about himself. And so trying to reconstruct what actually happened, plus like how he invented, you know, that persona to me was a big part of the appeal of that project. You know, I think whatever reason, I find those kinds of people really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can definitely, we'll circle back to anything you're working on now, you know, for your next project at the end. How about that?
That sounds great.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move into Asimov. And I want to start off with just sort of, you know, who Asimov is, why he's important, anything interesting about the author.
Sure. So to me, you know, the place to start with Asimov is to sort of underline how famous he was during his peak. You know, so when people picture Isaac Asimov, I'm guessing most of them picture sort of the mid to late Asimov, this guy who had these big, you know, plastic black glasses and these huge sideburns and had this very distinctive look. And he would show up on talk shows and he was sort of a public figure. You know, he would, you know, do lots of events and, you know, was a hugely popular science writer and kind of was this known quantity in a way that is pretty unusual. You know, I think there's no question he was the most famous science fiction writer in America at that point in terms of just if you showed someone a picture of him, they would probably recognize who he was, which is not true of most writers even now.
Yeah.
So that fame to me is worth underlining. But then kind of taking a step back and realizing that, you know, this is like a late stage in his career. And you know, the part of his life that I've spent the most time thinking about is much earlier when he was 18, 19 years old, a Russian immigrant who worked at his father's candy store in Brooklyn, who just wanted to be a science fiction writer. And, you know, that young Asimov, the one who was kind of nerdy and nervous and socially awkward and, you know, very bright, but lonely and looking for someone like Campbell to mentor him. That fascinates me because he becomes such an institution later on. He becomes so famous. He becomes literally the most prolific writer in American history, you know, hundreds of books, you know, which is incredible. But, you know, it didn't happen overnight. And that story to me is so interesting. The idea that this kind of scrawny kid would grow up to become this hugely influential figure that, you know, I think we kind of take for granted, right? But I think, you know, very little about his story was inevitable. There are all kinds of like really interesting twists and turns there where, you know, the outcome might have been very different, you know, if things had not gone quite as planned.
So he's kind of inextricably linked to Campbell, right? Because Campbell was sort of the person who discovered him. Is that fair to say?
Or developed him, I would say.
Developed, okay.
Yeah. So the context here is that Campbell has become the editor of Astounding, like, you know, like a year or two earlier. And he's really looking to develop the magazine into something distinct from other pulps at that time, right? He wants to improve the science. He wants to improve the quality of the writing. And, you know, his first idea is to kind of work with the writers who are there already. So there are a few writers like Jack Williamson who, you know, have the talents to kind of do the stuff that he has in mind. other people like Hubbard come in, you know, who he has to kind of work with, who are not necessarily science fiction writers, but have like followings among pulp readers. And then someone like Heinlein just comes in fully formed. I mean, Heinlein just shows up one day and he is everything that Campbell wants. So that's, you know, an incredible mm-hmm. stroke of luck. But Asimov is interesting because this is Campbell's experiment in seeing if he can develop a writer from scratch. Because when Asimov shows up, he is, I believe, 18 years old. He is not published anywhere. He writes a short story, you know, for the very first time and submits that to Campbell in person. So this is the first story he's ever written. And obviously it's not very good, but Campbell sees something there. And so because Asimov lives nearby, he can come and actually visit Campbell at the office in person, you know, once a month or so, and actually kind of become this protege. You know, Campbell is guiding him in terms of his development as a writer, but also, and I think we'll talk about this later on, you know, giving him ideas or stories and some of the most important ideas that Asimov is then associated with for the rest of his career come out of those like early conversations with Campbell. So that to me is the interesting part. It's this sort of partnership or mentorship that, you know, Asimov, you know, acknowledged very openly. You know, he said that he could not have done the stuff he did early on without Campbell's guidance.
Hmm. Cool. So in terms of sort of why Asimov should be read, I mean, some of what you've already talked about, the fact of his influence and kind of the fact of who he became, because he kind of became like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the time, but this mm-hmm. is a fiction author. And I mean, he wrote nonfiction as well. And I believe, was he trained as a scientist?
Yeah. So he's one of the very few scientists or science fiction writers from that period who actually did study science in college. You know, he became a professor of biochemistry at BU. So, you know, he definitely had the background to talk with some authority about these things.
Okay. And yeah, that's where the comparison with Neil deGrasse Tyson, just the idea of being a science communicator, and Asimov definitely was that, but also then a fiction author, which is fascinating.
Yes. And you know, and you asked like why we should talk about him, you know, yeah. I mean, there are various answers I could give. The obvious one to me is that some of those ideas are still really powerful. Mm-hmm. In particular, the three laws of robotics, which he developed with Campbell, and the idea of psychohistory from the Foundation series are two lasting ideas that have had a huge influence on people's lives and on the field. And I think even if you don't end up reading those stories, which have not always held up equally well, I think knowing the basics of those ideas is useful if you're going to spend time reading and writing science fiction.
Yeah, and when you think about the laws of robotics, right, it seeped into the rest of the popular culture, where even in the Alien series, right, you have Bishop, the android in or the artificial person, I believe he calls himself, in Aliens, and he says it's impossible for me to harm a human being, or by omission of action allow to be harmed a human being, and that's straight out of Asimov.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, you see it invoked in like other science fiction movies and stories, and even when people talk about AI, right? I don't know how much it's discussed within the field, but certainly in terms of popular culture, how we think about AI and robots, you know, those three laws are invoked all the time.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite little bits of Asimovian influence is I loved Buck Rogers as a kid. This was a show that was on in syndication when I was a kid. And on The Explorer, which was, they kind of had two different seasons of Buck Rogers, one where they were on Earth and another where they were on The Explorer. And the captain of that ship, he was an admiral, was named Admiral Asimov. So nice. That was fun. Yeah. So let's go ahead and move into sort of Asimov 101. So if people haven't read any of him, or if they're like, yeah, I've read some, but I want to make sure that I cover the basics, where should people start?
I would say start with Foundation, especially the first couple of stories and the published version of Foundation. Because again, like not all those stories have held up equally well, but the idea of psychohistory. So this is this idea that there is a science of prediction where you can forecast future events for centuries using symbolic logic and some kind of mathematics, you know, to the point where you can actually make choices that will influence the course of future events. All right.
Right.
And to me, this is an incredible idea. And I've talked about this before, you know, people have read those stories and have, you know, become economists, and they've entered the social sciences because they find the idea of psychohistory so compelling. And, you know, it's funny because like the stories themselves, they don't really make it clear what psychohistory is. You know, it is referred to multiple times. And, you know, it's something that you know, the main character or sort of like the central figure, Harry Seldon, can do, but you almost never see it being practiced. And so it's kind of hand wavy. It's a little vague about what psycho history is. But it's an incredible idea. You know, it's an incredibly exciting idea that you can kind of like foresee the fall of this galactic empire and then say, okay, well, we can do things to reduce the interregnum to sort of shorten the dark ages that follow. And so it's like in those first couple of stories, it introduces the idea, which, again, I think mostly comes from Campbell. I think if you look at the sequence of, you know, events that led to that series, I think Campbell was already interested in these things at the time that Asimov pitched that first story. And it was almost at Campbell's encouragement that he included those ideas. Yeah. And then later on, you know, there's some not so great stories in that series. But then in the second volume, there's a story called The Mule, which Campbell asked Asimov to write because he wants to disrupt psychohistory. He wants to say, are there things that psychohistory can't anticipate? And the result is, I think, probably the best story in that series, and maybe Asimov's single best story by some measures. So I would read the first couple of Foundation stories and then skip ahead to The Mule and then keep going from there if you want. I think that's kind of like a good introduction to the kind of story that Asimov was good at telling.
Yeah. And I mean, even somebody like me who was never a huge fan of the Foundation series, I didn't read it, you know, probably in the prime of my science fiction reading earlier in life. And so when I came to it a few years ago, it didn't completely work for me. I was never able to buy into psychohistory. I love the idea of it. It's just one of those things that I kind of go, yeah, I'm not sure I can get on board with it. But The Mule, that whole part was great.
Yeah. And, you know, it's important to, like, you know, kind of calibrate expectations for readers because, you know, not that much happens in these stories, right? This is, even Asimov talks about this. Like there is not a lot of action. There is not a lot of world building. There is not a lot of characterization. So you're like, what's left?
Yeah, conversations.
You literally have, and psychohistory, this idea that's like very generally, you know, sketched in. So they are kind of like funny stories to read because, again, they've changed lives. I mean, people love that idea, you know, but the actual experience of reading them is a little underwhelming sometimes. I know I'm not really giving this like the most the hardest sell in terms of trying to convince people to read them. But, you know, it's important to acknowledge this, right? And that to me is actually kind of inherently interesting too, that these stories could be so influential and so important to certain readers while not really giving you a lot of the things that you tend to associate with stories like this.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also important to think about the way that the Foundation stories were published, because they didn't emerge fully formed as a novel, right? These were serialized.
Yeah. I mean, Asimov originally, even he didn't want to write more than one story. The famous story here is that he is going to meet Campbell for their monthly meeting, and he's on the train there, and he's trying to think of like a good idea for a story, and he happens to be carrying a collection of Gilbert and Sullivan lyrics. And he looks at a page and sees an illustration of a century. And he's like, starts thinking about soldiers and empires. And is like, okay, how about I write like a story about like the decline and fall of the Galactic Empire? Right. And for him, this is like a novelette, you know, just a one-off story. And Campbell, you know, likes the idea, but he says, it's going to be a whole series. We're going to do a whole series with a shared backdrop. And it's going to have psychohistory. And Asimov kind of agrees, because he has no choice. And he goes home and tries to sketch out the future history the way that Heinlein kind of did for his stories. And he can't. Like, he is not that kind of writer. Like, he gives up and says, I'll just write the first story and go from there. And so, you know, there are often examples in the Foundation series where you can tell this was not planned out. And there are certain things where you can tell that Asimov sometimes will like kind of say, oh, here's the solution that I'll tell you in the next story. And he doesn't actually have the solution yet. he has to kind of figure out like what, you know, the answer is. So it shows, right? And these were lightly revised, I think, later on, but not in a way where they kind of, especially the first few stories, add up to a coherent narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, a good idea to acknowledge there's people who really struggle with, you know, 50s science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I get it, because modern science fiction tends to be softer. It tends to be more character driven, where this, the older stuff, you get a lot of great ideas, like you said. And, you know, you don't get the great characterization. Even the plotting isn't amazing, but the ideas are great.
Right. All right. And, you know, like this also extends to the robot stories, you know, because I didn't mention those on purpose because I actually have very little interest in those original robot stories. I think, again, the Three Laws are fascinating, but very few of those stories are worth reading as narrative. You know, like some of them have like clever twists, but you know, they're the kind of story where like if someone like tells you the twist, like that is, you know, you can summarize the twist ending in like a paragraph, and that gives you the same satisfaction as like actually reading this like 10-page story that kind of laboriously lays out, you know, like the you know, build up to this twist. Yeah. And that's true of like most of those stories. Like later on they get okay, but or you know, he gets better as a writer. And there are stories that he writes, you know, like later on that I would recommend wholeheartedly. But you're right. I think especially now, and again, Asimov was like in his early 20s, like he was a young guy, you know, who was not super experienced as a writer at that stage. And so, yeah, so the stories hold up because of the ideas that he developed with Campbell. But with a few exceptions, you know, they don't really, you know, it's hard to recommend them to people who are not prepared to make that mental adjustment to, you know, the quality of the stories from that period.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to admit, I absolutely love the iRobot stories. I reread them every few years. And you're right. There's a few of them where I'm like, I wouldn't read this if I wasn't setting out to read the whole book.
Right.
Because it's really all about that last little twist in there.
Yeah.
The thing that I love about them, though, and I think it's important to keep in mind for AI these days, is he presents the three laws as this perfect way of keeping robots safe. But every one of these stories shows that there is wiggle room to cause all kinds of problems if you don't do it properly. And so that certainly with AI these days, you know, the idea of there being safeguards, needing to be safeguards around AI is important, but we also have to keep in mind, we may think that we've got safeguards in place, but who knows? We won't really know.
Yeah. And that's part of the fun, right? You have these like three laws that seem pretty solid, but there are all these loopholes, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, the pleasure is watching Asimov like trying to come up with these exceptions and trying to find ways that, you know, the robots don't behave in the way that you'd expect.
Yeah. I particularly love the story Runaround, where a robot has to go out and retrieve something in order for the humans that it's paired with to survive. But it gets to a point where it's sensing there's a possible threat to its own existence in between it and the goal. It can't go back because it can't disobey the order. It can't go forward because it has to protect its own existence. And it's basically stuck there because the humans are in danger as well. And so unless something changes, it's stuck at that even potential between those forces.
Yeah, and that's a fun idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's fun to talk about it. You know, it's not always fun for me to read those stories.
Yeah.
You know, because as you say, like they really exist only to deliver that little idea. And there isn't a lot there otherwise.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories in iRobot is Liar, the one where there's, and this is very important in the Foundation series, where there's a robot that has, what would you call it? ESP, essentially, right? Mind reading. And that becomes important in some of the later Foundation books. But I have a really hard time with it just because Asimov isn't great at writing female characters. Susan Calvin is a really cool character, and this story makes her look kind of pathetic. But I still do love it. So I'm really torn.
Yeah, I mean, Susan Calvin is someone, I like the idea of her more than the way she's written, you know, in many of these stories. And I think it's worth mentioning, you know, Asimov was not good at writing women, you know, and he, at this stage especially, he had not spent a lot of time around women. And he was this, again, like I keep saying this kind of like shy guy who, you know, was hoping to like go on dates and never really did until he got married. And it shows, and it's not until like, you know, maybe the Mule era that you start to see women who are, you know, even halfway engaging in these stories.
Yeah. Okay. So other Asimov 101 titles.
Well, Nightfall is another one that I think is worth mentioning because this is also, along with, you know, iRobot Foundation, that Nightfall is the third sort of major story that Asimov develops with Campbell. So that famously, Campbell calls in Asimov to the office one day, and he reads Asimov a quote from an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Right. If you give me 1 second, I can find the exact quote. Mm-hmm. Here it is. So the line is, if the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the resemblance of the city of God which had been shown? And so Campbell reads that line to Asimov, and he says, what do you think would happen, Asimov, if men were to see the stars for the first time in 1,000 years? And Asimov says, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then Campbell says, I think they would go mad. I want you to write a story about that. So, you know, and then they discuss like sort of the various reasons that, you know, maybe the stars wouldn't appear for 1,000 years. And Asimov heads back home and writes, you know, this story, which, you know, is actually very readable. I think mm-hmm. it's actually readable in ways that maybe some of the other stories we've talked about so far are not. It's later voted the best science fiction story of all time, which I think is a bit of an overstatement, but, you know, clearly it was a huge hit. It kind of established Asimov as a major writer, you know, at a time when that did not seem likely. And, you know, I mean, it's written in this like very readable kind of fast paced style. That's fun. You know, the ending is really cool. But again, this is a story that Campbell essentially assigns to Asimov. And I don't want to like underrate how hard it is. And even Asimov later says, it's true that Campbell gave me the idea, but then I had to go and actually write the thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and yeah, it definitely reflects like his talent and imagination. But, you know, again, like this sort of what I think even Asimov later calls this symbiotic partnership they had, you know, results in like these three major stories or series, but before Asimov is even 25 years old. So again, like if you're interested in like that sort of period and kind of how this editor and this writer could collaborate, yeah, Nightfall is a great example of what can result.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll say for anybody who wants to read that, if you pick up Nightfall and Other Stories, there's a good intro to it mm-hmm. from Asimov, where, you know, he kind of objects to it being his greatest story ever because it's quite early.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good one just because one skillful thing in that one, I think, is setting it so close to the actual event that's coming, where they're in this system, some kind of chaotic system, where they have essentially had full daylight for 1,000 years. And no one has seen the night sky before. No one's seen the stars. And they all believe when they see the stars, they will all go mad. They will all die. And not just because they see the stars, but because the darkness. And yeah, that's a good one. We actually covered that one on Take Me to Your Reader not too long ago because there's two very bad film adaptations of it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting the way it's structured because it is almost set in real time, mm-hmm. you know, and it kind of like cuts between characters. You know, it's a fun story. And, yeah. And I think it's not a premise in itself that you would obviously end up with a classic if you wrote it, you know, for Campbell's specifications. I think Asimov was the one who kind of found the way into that story to make it fun and readable.
Yeah. Okay. So I think did you have a couple more titles for Asimov 101?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to skip ahead a little bit, you know, I do want to talk about a few stories that are, I think, just worth reading in themselves,
yeah,
you know, more so than maybe some of the ones that are mostly of historical interest. So The Last Question, I think, mm-hmm. is a pretty good one. This is probably Asimov's favorite of his own stories. And I think, you know, he famously said, you know, reading it, you know, it was the best science fiction story I'd ever written and maybe anyone had ever written. And it is a really cool story. Like you know, I don't want to give away the ending because that's kind of the whole point.
It is the whole point. Yeah.
You know, it is just a very, exciting story told on the largest possible scale. You know, it spans, I'm going to say millions of years probably of narrative time. And it explores this question of like, yeah, so what do you do as the universe starts to wind down? If you're a civilization, isn't there like an inherent endpoint to how long you can survive just because entropy will eventually, you know, increase to the point where there's nothing can happen again. Mm-hmm. And that's a good question. You know, it's a very compelling question. And he comes up with like a very interesting resolution, which I encourage people to seek out.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that one. And I don't want to spoil it because it's a relatively short story and yes. it's great. Yeah. Any other ones you want to highlight?
The last one I wanted to mention was The Bicentennial Man, which I think is probably the best robot story he wrote. And, you know, and again, like, this is a story that to me testifies to how much he grew as a writer, because you compare the style of the story, you know, Asimov always said that he tried to write very straightforward prose. You know, it was not meant to be stylish or beautiful, just very, you know, matter of fact and functional. But, you know, he clearly advances enormously as a writer over the course of his career. And if you compare the writing in Bicentennial Man with the writing in the early robot stories, it's obvious that he grew in ways that, you know, I don't think even he acknowledged, but, you know, those late stories are very well written.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he touches on anti-robot prejudice in a lot of the stories and a lot of the series, right? In certainly in the Caves of Steel, Elijah Bailey stories and Ardaniel Oliva. But yeah, in Bicentennial Man, right, how can a robot be accepted as a human? And that, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So again, it's a good premise, but it's also like really well written. And I think, you know, the robot character, the center of that story is very, I don't know, it's very moving. It's a very evocative story in ways that I don't think Asimov was even capable of doing earlier on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ready to move on to Advanced Asimov?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you have for me in Advanced Asimov? I know one of them.
Well, let's get to it. I think there's enough to talk about with End of Eternity that I would like to kind of start there.
Okay. Sounds good.
So Asimov did not start writing novels until after the war. And this is part because there wasn't really a market for original science fiction novels, you know, during the time when he was first starting out. Mm-hmm. And the first few novels he writes are not that great. Like, you know, things like Current of Space, The Stars Like Dust, you know, it's actually very hard to recommend those even for historical interest, at least to me. They are not very well done.
I've tried them. I think I read one of them and then I petered out on that series.
Yeah. Yeah. So it takes him a little bit of time to figure out how to write novels. I think you mentioned The Case of Steel and Naked Sun are robot novels that are actually really good, you know, and they're very clever mystery stories, actually. You know, they do a good job of telling like a mystery story in a science fiction framework, which is actually like a pretty tricky thing sometimes.
Yeah.
So, you know, even there, you're starting to see like him get better. And then jumping ahead a little bit to the end, he writes the Gods Themselves, which I think is actually a really good novel. I think some people disagree about that one, but I think it's actually very well written and interesting. In ways that, again, were not true of his earlier work. But I think, you know, the novel I would recommend if you're just going to read one Asimov novel is The End of Eternity, which is not one of his better known books because it doesn't really fit into any other chronology. I think sort of does.
Yeah.
I think there are hints later on that it's part of the Foundation universe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not an obvious robot story. It's not an obvious Foundation story. It's kind of out there on its own. But I think it's actually this like really interesting, well-written novel full of ideas that kind of play with some of the concepts from his other work in ways that I actually think are really interesting.
Yeah. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about this and kind of entice people to read it. So how would you kind of give a quick elevator pitch for it?
I think you've actually like read it more recently than I have.
Yeah.
So do you want to give your version of like a plot summary?
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of some more recent stuff like This Is How You Win, How You Lose the Time War, because it involves Eternals, right, that are part of this organization called Eternity. And they travel along the timeline and conduct exchanges and trades between different eras of humanity, trying to minimize suffering. And in order to do that, they make these little micro changes and then keep track of, you know, exactly what will happen from that. And it reminds me a little bit of Psychohistory.
I want to like get to later. I think that's a good connection.
Yeah. And where you have this character, Andrew Harlan, who takes on a trainee and finds out there's a bit of a bootstrap paradox going on. He doesn't become aware of that right away, but just the idea of and some of the language that's used in it, like traveling upwind and downwind, I think is just great. I enjoy when language oddities make sense, and that very much did here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned like other works that, you know, it reminds you of. I actually watched Tenet, you know, Chris Nolan's Tenet recently, and I actually, you know, it kind of reminded me a bit of this novel, this idea of this like, you know, this like cold war between the past and the future, or like between different points in the timeline, I think is implicit in Asimov's premise.
Yeah.
And you know correctly that, you know, this does remind you a little bit of Foundation. It reminds you a little bit of Psychohistory. And I think that's really interesting because I don't want to like give away the ending, but at the end, the main character essentially concludes that eternity is a bad thing. That, you know, these guys are psychopaths who are trying to exercise this control over how civilizations evolve. And I think the difference is that with eternity, because there's time travel involved, you can kind of see the consequences.
Yes.
You can see within one person's lifetime, you can see what effects these changes have on societies in a way that you really can't with Foundation, because it's all one direction, you know, with Foundation. And to me, that's so interesting because it does kind of get at this like weirdness with Psychohistory that I think Asimov is aware of, that who are these guys, right? Like who are these guys who call, who like take it upon themselves to decide what's best for the rest of us? You know, what is the desirable direction? Because, you know, in Foundation, it's like pretty clear cut. It's like you have this like awful dark age interregnum after the empire falls. But, you know, like it's not always clear, right? It's not always clear, like what is the correct direction for a society to take? And the idea that you have assumed that you are the best person qualified to decide this for other people, you know, as Muff notes, is like a little bit disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the, I mean, it's almost a theodicy question, right? In a religious context, right, of well, why would you do these things, you know, and what is the cost of it? Because making these changes, you make entire realities disappear. And that's where, in this book, Harlan meets a woman and then realizes that there's a coming change that's going to erase her existence. And that really puts into sharp relief exactly what the cost of minimizing suffering can be.
Yeah. And I think that ambivalence is really interesting because, you don't really see it in the Foundation series as much. You know, I haven't read the later novels in a while, but, you know, one thing, my theory about Psychohistory is that this was essentially Campbell's idea that Asimov accepted because it meant he could publish these stories. But I don't think Asimov himself was ever that comfortable with the idea of Psychohistory, which is kind of funny because it's so central to the Foundation series.
Yeah.
But if you read like the later novels, this is like Foundation's Edge and like the novels he wrote after Campbell was gone, you know, Psychohistory actually ends up playing a smaller part in the story over time. You know, it kind of brings in more of Asimov's own ideas, and Psychohistory is downplayed a little bit. And I've never seen Asimov like say this explicitly, but I do like to think that Eternity is him kind of working through some of his own qualms about, you know, the way Psychohistory would function in practice.
I always warn people, if you're going to read the Foundation series, it's going to introduce the concept of we're going to be able to reduce that interregnum to 1,000 years, but the books will only cover like 500 years.
Right.
So you're never going to get to that 1,000 years. And there are reasons, and it makes sense.
I mean, in some ways, you know, Eternity is like a better candidate for adaptation, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, the Foundation series, the TV series that Apple did recently, to me is like a, you know, it's just like very challenging premise for a TV show, because, you know, it's very hard to say, okay, we're going to tell this story spanning millennia. But if you have time travel, you can kind of do these things and see the consequences, you know, in a way that I think is actually more amenable to a TV series or a movie. So I would actually love to see a TV series based on this book.
Yeah. It would be fascinating, especially once you get into that kind of bootstrap paradox stuff. That you have. And, you know, at some point, Harlan becomes very ambivalent about the existence of eternity. Is this a good thing? Do we want this to actually be a thing? What would happen if eternity went away? Might that be better for humanity?
Yeah, which is not a question that you really see addressed in the Foundation series.
Right. I was surprised when it got to sort of a, it's not even really an oblique reference. I think if you read the Foundation novels, there's a point where you're like, oh, okay, there's the tie-in. Because I think Asimov did go to some lengths to tie all of his fiction together at some point.
Yeah, so if I recall correctly, there is a implication that Eternity has done things that lead to the creation of an all-human galaxy, right? which is pretty interesting, right? Because, you know, that is a very distinctive feature of the Foundation series. Like, there are no aliens.
Right.
And the sort of historical reason for this is that Campbell had this like weird thing where the alien always had to lose,
right,
and the alien always had to be shown to be less intelligent than the human. And Asimov thought that was like a real limitation on the kinds of stories you could tell. And so he decides to just avoid the issue altogether by writing stories that are either about robots or that take place in a universe where there aren't other species or other intelligent species. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, right? And so I like the idea that you can kind of justify this within like the logic of these stories by saying, oh, well, there's this other reason why there would be a galaxy with only humans.
Yeah. Anything else for, do you want to talk about anything else about the end of eternity, or you want to move on to something else?
I think I'm good. I'm glad we managed to cover it, because again, it's a book that I think more people would enjoy if they.
And you know, part of the challenge here is not to talk too much about it, because I feel like this is the one we're saying, okay, if you've read some Asimov and you want to read something a little more advanced, then I don't want to spoil it, right?
Right. Right. Agreed.
And I'll just say, I thought it was tremendous. I thought it was very well plotted. It kept me guessing, and yeah.
Yeah, which is not something that you tend to associate with Asimov. I think the density of the ideas is actually really fun, because often Asimov will have like one good idea per story, and this one has a bunch of them. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah. I thought there was an interesting relationship between Harlan and I can't remember his boss's name. And there's more than one boss, and there's this sort of interdepartmental rivalries and stuff, right, where he gets suspicious. And I thought, is this reflecting on his relationship with Campbell? But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while, but it's quite possible. Mm-hmm. There definitely are like Campbell surrogates if you look closely enough at some of these stories.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else for Advanced Asimov? Any places you would recommend people go if they've read Foundation, they've read iRobot, they've read the Robot series?
Would this include nonfiction?
Sure.
So I do want to underline his nonfiction, okay, because he actually was better known for years as a nonfiction writer. He became kind of famous as a science popularizer to the mainstream in a way that he was not famous outside science fiction circles as a fiction writer. Because, like, you know, number one, like, his books on science and history hold up, I think, really well. You know, I'm working on a project now that involves like a lot of physics, and, you know, whenever I'm confused by something or I need like an explanation, I'm like, did Asimov write about this at any point? Because, you know, that will be a clearly written, engaging account of this subject.
Okay.
You know, no matter what it is. And that is a huge deal. Like, that is not easy to be as good a nonfiction writer as he was. So I recommend those. And I also recommend his memoirs. You know, so if you go online and, you know, look for used copies, you know, there are a few different volumes, but the ones I'd recommend are a couple of books that he published in the 70s. One's called In Memory Yet Green. And the other is In Joy Still Felt. And these are two like phone book sized memoirs. I mean, my copies are like, I'm looking at them right now. They're like read to pieces, because Asimov essentially had a diary, and it allowed him to write these memoirs that seemed to cover every day of his life. Wow. And, you know, and again, it has things like, you know, him taking his car into the garage, you know, like all this stuff that is like very mundane, just running errands. You know, and because he didn't have the most eventful life by some measures. He was just like writing all the time. But they're incredibly fun. If you're interested in like science fiction, history, there are tons of good stories about other writers from that period, about Campbell. And just like the life of being a writer. To me, as someone who wants to be a writer, or, you know, has like kind of had these ambitions for a long time, it's really engaging to see him talk about how he built that career step by step to the point where he could write about whatever he wanted.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to think if in Night Vale and other stories, there's some place, some anthology of his that I've read that has sort of excerpts from his memoir.
Well, most of his collections include autobiographical prefaces.
Okay, maybe that's right.
So you know, those are really fun to seek out. Like, there's a book called The Early Asimov that has a ton of autobiographical writing in it. A lot of the reprints of like his earlier novels will include a foreword where he talks about his processes and kind of like, you know, kind of where he was in his life when he wrote these stories. that stuff is phase. It's great. I really find that stuff fascinating. And he is a again, like for some of the reasons why maybe his fiction can be a little bit less engaging, his nonfiction is incredibly readable because it is very straightforward. It's very conversational. You know, you kind of feel like you're part of this club. I guess is the way it makes me feel. It's like you were part of like that world of writers from the 30s who knew each other and hung out and had interesting drama. You know, like this very conversational tone really pulls you in and makes that yeah. Period seem very vivid.
Yeah, I think people may underrate how collaborative things were at that time, because you know, you look at today and we have fandom on the internet, and so we can through Twitter and Discord and all these other places we can interact with like-minded people. At that time, it was a slower pace, right? Because I think Asimov started off writing letters into the editor, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was a fan first, right? Yeah. Which is like, to me, an important part of that story, that he was a fan writing letters, eventually getting involved with fan clubs, kind of in parallel to his development as a writer.
Yeah. Any of the science titles in particular that you would recommend, just because I think that sounds fun?
The one that I remember reading, you know, when I was younger is called A Choice of Catastrophes. And it's a book about different ways in which the world could end.
Oh, cool.
You know, and one of them, like one chapter talks about the entropy problem that he talks about in the last question.
Right.
But from a more, like a more scientific point of view. Mm-hmm. And, I would have been probably in like middle school when I read that book. And yeah, no, I mean, I and this is like one out of hundreds, you know, yeah. I could have ended up, you know, probably getting in like a used bookstore. I just got his book on the slide rule, which is really fun. I have a slide rule and I haven't gotten around to learning how to use it yet. But when I do, I will turn to him. And he has these joke books that are really fun. It's just like him like writing down all the jokes he can think of and then having a little introduction, you know, to explain why they're funny, or like, you know, the period in his life where, you know, that he associates with that joke. And the jokes themselves are like fine. They're not always that great, but the little asides and notes are really fun.
What's the level of offensiveness in the jokes?
I think it's been a while since I read them. I imagine that some are like a little bit dirty. Okay. You know, he famously was like really good at writing limericks that were like a little bit off color.
Okay.
And the other thing I should mention, and this seems like a good segue into this point, because I was thinking about, you know, he wrote this parody book called The Sensuous Dirty Old Man, which again, not that great, but reflects a fact about Asimov that I should mention, which is that, you know, he was a serial groper and harasser of women, which, you know, it has to be said, you know, he probably touched or kissed hundreds of women over the years at conventions and fan gatherings and other events, and also in private, in ways that are really awful.
Yeah.
And to me, that's part of the story, too, because as I say, here's a guy who was this like nerdy, lonely guy as a young man who was very awkward around women, who then later on in middle age ends up being famous in this, you know, kind of particular community that gives him power over women.
Yeah.
And he uses that power in this very offensive way that, you know, was kind of dismissed. It was seen as this like kind of like quirky, funny thing he did. And it's not until recently that, you know, people are starting to say, oh, that was really bad.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, made these women feel uncomfortable or unsafe, and it probably affected the, you know, how welcome they felt, you know, within, you know, that world for a long time. So, you know, I can't talk about Asimov without at least mentioning that aspect of his story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's especially like post Me Too, right? Yes. This is very topical and important to talk about.
Yeah. So, and again, I try to mention this because it is part of his legacy, unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything else for Advanced Asimov, or we can kind of move into summing up?
I think I've covered everything I wanted to talk about. So yeah, let's move on.
Cool. And you know, I when I originally reached out to you, you know, obviously one idea was to do an episode on Campbell, but you suggested we start with Asimov, and then maybe we can circle back and do Campbell another time.
Yes. No. Another problematic figure of enormous importance. Yes. Anytime. I'm a Campbell guy. Like Campbell's kind of like where I began my journey as a science fiction historian and biographer. So I have plenty to say about him.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things to talk about with him would be, you know, the places where he put his thumb on the scale, right? It was like, no, yeah. You can't have a nice ending for the Cold Equations. She has to die, you know, or I can't remember if that was him who mandated that, but, you know, just in other fiction where he had certain things that he wanted to see in his fiction. And if he didn't have it, I'm not interested in that story.
Yeah, you know, and you see this with Dune, you know, toward the end, you know, this whole, I mean, for like 30 years, let's say, you know, there are all these like inflection points where Campbell, you know, had certain preconceived ideas about what science fiction was or what a story should do that did kind of influence the direction that these careers took.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll keep that in just because, you know, that's right. Maybe as a teaser for a future episode, although I have so many of these on the books at this point that, you know, I'll get back to you sometime next year. And
that works fine, actually.
Okay. Well, so I think we're wrapped on Asimov. I definitely recommend people check him out. And when I did a survey a while back, I didn't Ask Me Anything episode. And somebody asked about, you know, do I think that Golden Age science fiction will continue to be read in the future? You know, fast forward 50, 100 years. And my thinking is that it's influential enough that people will always want to go back and see where the genre came from. But I thought I would ask you about it as well.
I mean, I think it'll be read in the way any, you know, genre fiction is read from the past. I think certain stories and authors will endure. You know, I think like Campbell's Who Goes There, which, you know, became the thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a story that will endure. I think a lot of Heinlein will hold up really well, if anything can. And like, you know, a few stories here and there that stand out for other reasons. I don't know if, you know, because even like even now, right, during at this moment, it's unclear to me whether Asimov is still being read by 20-year-olds.
Right.
You know, is he just a name in the way that, let's say, like Doc Smith or someone, you know, it was just a name for people of an earlier generation who at the time was seen as this canonical writer. So I don't know. It's very hard to say. There's new stuff being produced all the time and, you know, it tends to drive out the old stuff and then get driven out in turn itself. But no, I think there are going to be stories that are going to be of interest for as long as people are reading science fiction. It's just very hard to know in advance what those stories will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's, before we sign off, anything that you're working on?
So, I'm currently working on a biography of, the physicist Luis W. Alvarez. So I don't know if you've seen Oppenheimer yet.
Yeah.
So in Oppenheimer, there's a scene where Oppenheimer sees this guy running out of a barber shop. He says, "Alvarez, what's going on?" And Alvarez has just seen a newspaper article about, you know, the first confirmed splitting of the atom. And then Oppenheimer proves why that can't be done. And Lawrence says, "But come next door, you know, Alvarez has done
right.
it." And so you have this like cool scene where like Alvarez shows Oppenheimer, you know, this, you know, the scope, you know, to show, you know, this reaction, and Oppenheimer realizes immediately that it could be a bomb. And then Alvarez disappears. You never see him again, maybe in the background a few times. But that's who I'm writing about because he is an incredibly interesting guy, like more interesting than Oppenheimer, I'm going to say, in a lot of ways, because, you know, he clearly had a huge role in the Manhattan Project. He went on to be the scientific observer at the bombing of Hiroshima. So he was there. He then went on to do important work in particle physics, win a Nobel Prize. And then, you know, later on, he did incredible work on things like the JFK assassination and the extinction of the dinosaurs, because he was the scientist who came up with the asteroid impact theory, that this is what wiped out the dinosaurs during the KT event. And this is when he was retired, essentially, and he, you know, not a paleontologist, just someone who came across this evidence that he was able to correctly, I think, interpret. So yeah, so just a very smart guy, this like kind of freelance detective scientist type who just did cool things for 50 years. So yeah, so I'm writing his story now. And again, like I was saying before, this attempt to move from science fiction to someone like Fuller, who is sort of a science fiction hero in the real world, to Alvarez, who in some ways was the real deal. Like you know, you talk about the competent man. And one sort of interesting thread and astounding my book is that all these guys saw themselves as competent men of the kind they had spent their lives writing about. You know, they thought they were that hero. And they thought that during World War II and afterward, at least all this weird stuff of Scientology, you know, it's just that kind of strange thing where you think you are more qualified maybe than you actually are to solve these problems in the way that a science fiction hero can. And Fuller is similar. I think his solutions are often flawed. Whereas Alvarez solved real problems in a huge range of fields for years. And again, like also a complex figure with, you know, a interesting personality that made him difficult to work with sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I think a genius and kind of a, you know, competent man in a way that I think was genuine. And you know, trying to get at what it means to be that figure for real in real life.
Nice. Any due date for that? Any expectation of when that'll be published?
Ideally in 2025.
Okay.
I would like to get it out by like August 2025. If it could be a little bit later than that, I'm guessing. But I'm currently going through the Alvarez papers and learning all this physics, as I mentioned, with Asimov's help. Going to start the actual writing pretty soon. So we'll see. But it'll be like a 2+ year project.
Okay.
Overall.
What's your educational background training? Do you have a science degree or just a science hobbyist?
Science hobbyist. Okay. I actually studied classics in college. So, you know, Latin and Greek, which has not been incredibly relevant to my chosen profession so far. But yeah, so this is interesting too, right? Like, I'm not a scientist and I have ended up writing about these, you know, fairly technical topics over time. And that's been part of the challenge. It's part of the point. Like, I'm trying to learn these things myself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of why I enjoy writing these books. But, you know, definitely having like good readers, like good experts I can consult helps a lot. You know, trying to minimize, you know, the mistakes I make. But again, someone like Asimov, you know, like popularizations of these ideas are hugely important and valuable because, you know, these are ideas that should be part of people's lives, right? And I think that's what Asimov realized. I think that was his goal, was to become, you know, the world's best explainer for people like me.
Cool. Okay, well, I think that's pretty much zoomed out Asimov in the books. So, Alec, I want to thank you again so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I had a great time. This was a really good conversation.
Yeah, and so where can people find you?
So the name is Alec Neville Ali, which is pretty distinctive. So if you Google me, you'll find me on Twitter occasionally. I have a blog that is not updated very, very often. But, you know, more to the point, you know, my email address is there. So if people want to reach out, I love hearing from readers or fans. So please feel free to contact me.
Yeah. And I've been on podcasts a couple times with Alec, hosted by David Agronoff. We did. I was on that panel discussion where I felt like I'm the odd man out here, just a podcaster with Gary K. Wolf and you and Lisa Jozsik.
That's right.
And then we talked about that Clifford Simak story with David as well, and that was fun. Space sports ball.
Yeah. Anytime I get this kind of invite, I'm delighted because, you know, I have moved on in some ways to other projects, but this is kind of like, I think the work for which I'll be best known. And so I'm always really happy to talk about it.
Yeah. So I'll encourage people to check out any links I put in the show notes for Alec. Check out his books. Astounding is excellent. Inventor of the Future is also great. So, all right. Well, thanks, Alec. We'll talk again down the line.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye. Alrighty, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Alec about Isaac Asimov and, of course, ranging onto other topics that are of interest to Alec. Make sure you check out any of his links in the show notes. Read Astounding. It's really terrific. Great overview of the kind of history of the golden age of science fiction, not overlooking any faults in the various authors at the time. Really, really good stuff. I can say that the Audible version is a very good audio production. That's how I took it in. So I'm curious to hear from you what you think of this kind of episode. I'm already planning to do more of them. So if you just think that I should stop, well, you can maybe keep that to yourself. But if you liked it, let me know. And I would welcome suggestions for other authors. If you are someone who is very, very, very much up on an author's overall work, you know, Alec told me when we were emailing back and forth, he's like, I haven't read all of his nonfiction. And so, you know, I can't speak authoritatively to all of that, but you don't need to be, you know, a graduate level expert in an author. If there's somebody that you've just read extensively and you think you can talk about why they should be read, some basics and some more advanced topics, great. Reach out to me. I have these booked already for Bradbury. I have one for Philip K. Dick. I tentatively have one for Heinlein as well. But I would love to cover, you know, a lot of the Golden Age authors. I'd love to cover some newer authors as well. And so if you want to do that, then reach out to me. So just as a reminder, I am going on a kind of a 4-month cycle where I do a normal episode, which I've already done. You would have already heard that about Planet of the Apes, and then zoomed out episode. And then I'm going to go back and do another normal episode about an award winner. I won't reveal the title right now. I will post about it on social media once I confirm my guest, and you'll see that next in the feed. Then we'll go back to another zoomed out, and then to another, we're just going to kind of alternate between zoomed out episodes and regular episodes on a single book. Sometimes more than one book if they're in a series. I do want to remind you, if you want to support this podcast in any way, you can, of course, share the post on social media, talk about it with your friends, leave a review any place that you listen to the podcast. That's always very helpful. I don't pay a ton of attention, I have to admit, to reviews. I need to go and do another kind of review crawl to see if anybody's left recent reviews. And if you want to support financially, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast. And sign up there to support on a monthly basis. If you'd rather do a one-off thing, buy me a book, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/SethHeaselD. I'll make sure that there's a link in the show notes for that. Okay, I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.